Muriel Gardner, Reel 3.
And so they had gone down to this factory where they'd been employed as slave labour, and it dealt with artificial leather and linoleum. And they had got into huge vats of industrial alcohol, methyl alcohol, and they had brought that back into camp thinking it was vodka, and they had had a great carousal, and 20 of them had died then and there, and the others had taken them out into the forest and buried them. And they thought that this must be very strong vodka if it would kill a man, and so we must treat it with great respect, and we must only drink it in small quantities, which they continued to do. And one has to remember that the people from the concentration camps, they were only the peasant people who were left, because as a matter of policy, Hitler had killed off immediately any of the intellectuals or academics were drafted into the concentration camps. They were immediately killed off, because Hitler didn't want any sort of rebellion or revolt fomented against him. And so they were killed off. So you were only left with the peasant mentality, which was what Hitler wanted, to be slaves forever of the German Reich. So it was a peasant mentality which was thinking this. And so they continued to drink this. Well, we had a great problem, because within a fortnight of arriving in camp, we had 850 cases of almost complete paralysis on our hands. But this answers your other question, because this forced the doctor to start building a proper hospital, because he had to care for the basic needs of these 850 people. And so he started from the rubble, and there was plenty of rubble lying about the camp from all the battered buildings and so on. He started with this person's labour to build from scratch a hospital, originally where he could care for these people. But over the 2 years, it became a very sophisticated hospital with 140 beds and two operating theatres and dentistries and clinics. So that when a lieutenant colonel, a medical lieutenant colonel, was visiting the camp after 2 years and doing an inspection of the hospital, his final comment was that it compared very favourably with any hospital in a small town in the United States of America. And so that was a great achievement. But it started from this necessity of looking after these 850 people. It was a great tragedy, really, because in a great carousal to celebrate their freedom, they had drunk this poison unknowingly. Nothing that could be done, and we had to ship them back eventually to Russia in ambulance trains.
I was wondering also about the concentration camp people who came in. Would they have gone into the hospital as well when it was built, or would the hospital have been built after that time? I wondered how you cared for those in a medical way when these truckloads came through. Would they have got any medical attention? Would it have been possible?
Well, they got very little medical attention. There were only the four dogs to begin with, you see, and so there was very little that the doctor could do until he could wheedle out, which he did, nurses from, he could find nurses within the various nationalities. And these formed the basis, really, of his medical setup in the beginning. Really, there was so much to do that you didn't really know what the doctor was doing half the time, because you were so busy with your own particular problem.
Did you have many deaths, though? Were people dying
very
on
few,
you?
Extraordinarily few. And this amazed even the army. And I think it was because only the tough survived in the concentration camps and slave labor camps. All the weak were killed off. And I had one rather chilling interview with a young girl and from the concentration camps, and she was saying that in order to survive in the concentration camps, you have to have some sort of incentive to look forward to. And she said you have no hope at all, and you have to have something that you could look forward to. And she said, in our camp, we used to watch the input of people, the new people coming in, and we would bet on them, on which you thought would last the longest. And then in the ensuing days, it gave you some interest to see how long the person you betted on lasted. And she said, you always knew that if there were people from the West rather than the East. They would probably die sooner because they were little, not, their physique was not such as they would withstand the horrors and the deprivations of concentration camp. And she said if you got intellectuals, you could always bet on them dying very quickly because either they would be killed off or they would die. And so Hitler killed off the intellectuals, and so you were left with this tough, basically tough, peasant stock of people. And it amazed the army that there was so little real disease in the camps. They thought typhus and typhoid would spread enormously, particularly the number of lice that they had and so on.
How did you cope with all the lice? You were saying you were educated very well with lice and bugs and fleas.
Yes.
And all these flies that you had, which you so graphically describe, the purple, you know, walls of flies. How did you cope with that in the beginning?
Well, notably, DDT had just been discovered. So we were sent by the American Army sacks and sacks of this new DDT. Then, of course, nobody knew that, as we know now, with DDT, you cannot use DDT now in this concentrated form that we had it. But we used it liberally. So when people came in, when we got an influx of people, they were deloused with this DDT. And so it was always great fun because you had these great guns squirting this powder on you. Squirted it down the fronts of men's trousers and down the back, and there was always a great deal of hilarity about it, and you scattered it over all their hair and so on, and we spread it liberally on the sheets that we went to on our, used on our beds. And so I shudder to think really what damage it probably did to the skin. I think probably the fact that I have very many warts on my skin is probably due to this. But it was scattered very liberally over our sheets so that you really were breathing in this DDT. But the fact that this time it just was a boon to mankind because it was very very effective in killing off the livestock that we had in the camp.
And that, of course, would have prevented, as you say, the spread of typhus and typhoid.
Yes. But basically what I think, because they were tough enough to withstand anything if they withstood the concentration camps as they really attempt.
Did you hear many stories from the people, you know, about their war experience? Would they have shared it with you? Did they want to talk, did you find?
Well, you had really very little time in the camp to get it in those early days to sort of spend time just chatting to people. There was so much needed doing that you were flat out all the time, so you didn't really get details. I can't remember details of stories that they told. What about the story of the early days in the camp when we had the weddings? So one of the first things that the Poles do in setting up a camp is to set up a church, because the Poles are, of course, Roman Catholic. And so one of the first things they do is set up a church. One of the first things the Baltic peoples do is set up schools. The first thing the Russians always do is set up a theatre. And the first thing that the Jews do, I believe, although we didn't have a Jewish camp, is set up a barber's shop. I think there's some ritual in haircutting for the Jews or something. But in the very early days, the Polish chief came to me and he said, "Madam, we would like to make a church. And there is a stable at the back of the camp, and we can't use it for accommodation. We wondered if we could have it for a church." So I went to have a look at this stable, and it was knee-deep in filth. It had been a cavalry stable. And it was knee-deep in filth and ammunition and so on, with great holes in the walls. And so I said, thought, well, if you can make a church of that, good luck to you. And so I said to him, yes, you can have it. So he said, well, we want to get the church ready for our national day, which is May 3rd. And so he said, I wonder if you could find a priest for us. So I said, yes, I thought we could find a priest. So we could get a priest from the American Army. And so he said, well, will you come to the services? So we said, yes, we will come to the service. So on May the 3rd, you've so much to do that you forget about the cold, you need them to get on with the church. And so it comes May the 3rd, and we appeared at the church. And they had done it beautifully. They had cleared it out, so they got it down to the original earth floor. And they'd gone into the forest, and they dug up saplings of larch and fir, and they planted them in the earth floor to cover up the holes in the walls. And they'd gone down to the local castle from which Count Philip's room had long since fled. And they had got the bathroom globes, the white globes, and they had put them on the altar, about 7 or 8 of them, on a rough altar that they had made. And this was a part of the camp which still at this time had electricity. So they had these lit, and it looked very fine. And the church was absolutely crowded. And the priest conducted the service in Latin, which of course they all understood. But the important thing was that they sang their hymns in Polish, in a language which they hadn't been allowed to use for 3 or 4 years. And it was a most moving service. There wasn't a dry eye in the church. Ours certainly weren't dry. And then after the service, the Polish chief came to me and he said, Madam, do you think we could borrow the Polish priest for next Saturday? So I said, yes, I thought we could. He said, well, a lot of our, we haven't, as you know, been allowed to marry in the concentration camps, in the slave labor camps. Part of their degradation was that they were never allowed to marry, so that the children should always be illegitimate and be slaves forever of the Reich. And so he said, a lot of our ladies are living with men that they have linked up with. And he said, I think that it would be a good idea if we got them married. And of course, 60 years ago, before there was any permissive society, this was a very heinous thing, and much more heinous than it is today. And so I said, yes, I could borrow the priest. And he said, now I wonder if you could get us any white material, because our ladies have only the rags that they stand up in. And if they could have some white wedding gowns, it would be rather magnificent. So I was very new at the time, and I tried all the legitimate means. I didn't see myself going to the American major in the middle of a war and asking for white material for wedding dresses. And so I said, now I could get the priest, but I couldn't get any white material. So he said, well, never mind, but you'll come to the weddings. Yes, we'll come to the weddings. And so when we turned up at the weddings, there was the priest, and in front of him there were 45 couples, brides and bridegrooms, and nearly every bride had a white wedding gown. So there had been some good persuasion gone on with the displaced persons and some German factory that made white material. They had got it. Of course they were only roughly made up, with no cotton, with no needles, with no thread, with no sewing machine or anything, and in many cases they were already pinned up. But they'd gone into the forest and they'd got sprigs of larch and fir, and they'd pinned them all over, and they looked very gay. Although the priest streamlined the weddings as best he could, it took him 3 hours to tie up all those wedding knots. So it was at that point that he found that the priest released from Dachau concentration camp and sent him, a Polish priest, who spoke English, and he was very, very useful to us.
I think you have, I remember seeing that on one of your videos, all these white, you know, the couples, the wedding couples. Would that be the occasion?
That was the occasion, yes indeed. A very happy occasion it was.
Yes, it must have been really something in that sort of atmosphere to have something so good.
Yes. Because, of course, these were very lawless days. I mean, the whole economy of Germany had broken down. They were very lawless days. So most of our men had got guns of some description. I mean, the German army, men were deserting and trying to get back home. And so the displaced persons were relieving them of their guns, anything to get power in your hands. And so it was a very lawless time, and you had to ride along with it until you could get some sort of idea of pride in your camp and so on. No doubt the Poles have gone out and persuaded some German manufacturers to release some white material for the wedding dresses. You see. But this was the sort of thing that went on. There was a great deal of pilfering went on.
Yes, it was interesting when you were saying earlier, you know, and now you've brought in the guns that the men had. that there had been a battle. Was there a lot? Did you have to be very careful about mines and ammunition?
Oh, we did indeed. Yes, yes. And that was one of the reasons why I started up schools, really, to get the children off the squares, because a child would pick up a little green, seemingly a little green ball, and of course it would be a hand grenade, and it would go off and blow off the child's hand. So they were in constant danger. And so, for that unworthy reason, I started up schools in the Polish camp, the Ukrainian camp, and the Russian camp. And they eventually blossomed into quite little establishments by the end of the 2 years, but they started from that need to get the children off the squares. And then the Italians were particularly good at clearing the ammunition, and we cleared the ammunition and we took it out into the forest, and they built deep, deep trenches and put it at the bottom and set fire to it and exploded it and got rid of it eventually in that way.
You were saying also, you know, this great range of skills that you had. And you know how you were putting these to use in order to rebuild the camp. And you know, how did that happen? Was it your husband who organised that? Did he organise, you know, work teams, or did he leave it to the people themselves?
I don't know. Difficult really to answer it. A lot of it came from themselves. I mean, it would stem from the chief's conference, what you were to do, how you were to repair the camp and get the water going, the gas going, the electricity going, and then you give the Russians certain jobs of perhaps cleaning the latrines and that sort of thing, and boarding them up. So you had to leave it a lot to them, to give them the ideas and let them work it out and get, you know, do the jobs themselves. And this is the whole point. If you can get them doing the jobs themselves, then it's very much better for them, because the only way to run a refugee camp, really, is to get everybody happily working on some purposeful job. And then you have a happy camp, otherwise you have a desolate camp. The more you do for refugees, really, the worse it is for them, paradoxically. You must give them the ideas and then let them get on with doing the jobs. So you give them the ideas that you want such and such a square clearing of ammunition, then you leave it to them to decide how and when they will do it, and apportion the jobs between themselves. But you haven't enough time anyway to.
And did the various nationalities, did they get on well together? Did you find, you know, the Ukrainians, the Poles, the Russians?
Not particularly, no. Mercifully, of course, you've got these four barracks, so you could separate them all. So the Ukrainians would never, ever go in the Russian camp, although they were part of the Soviet Union, of course, but they would never regard themselves as Russian. And so they always insisted upon being housed in the Polish camp. And so you had the Russians all in one camp, and the Poles all in one camp, the Ukrainians all in one camp. And then we had what we call an international camp for all the various nationalities, or about 20 nationalities in the camp. But the main blocks were Poles, Poles and Russians. And then you had about, I suppose, 12 to 1500 of assorted nationalities.
Were you ever involved with the forcible repatriation? You know, did the Russians ever come to your camp? Asking for the Ukrainians and Russians to be sent back.
Yes, it's a big problem, really, because the camp as it was in 1945 and the camp as it was in 1946 were two different places, really. Because in 1945, as I said, it mainly consisted of Poles and Russians, and counting Ukrainians as Russians, as I say, very few, perhaps 1,200, 1,500 of the assorted nationalities. Well, then after September, October 1945, most of the people who'd gone back home, who wanted to go back home, had gone back home. As soon as the war was over, the transport of people home began. So in the middle of all the rest that you had to do in camp, the army would suddenly say one evening, we will transport 500 people away from your camp tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. And you had, in that short space of time, to go up to camp and get everybody organised and onto trucks. And then, 8 o'clock, you'd all be ready and the army wouldn't come. And then at 10 o'clock, they still haven't come. Then at 11 o'clock, they would say the transport was off. And then, on one occasion, it had been put off twice in a day, and I was just leaving camp, and a Russian lieutenant came steaming up in a jeep, and he said, it's on now, and it'll be on at 2 o'clock. And so you had all this messing about when you were still trying to run the refugee camp and all of that involved. But by October, early October 1945, all those who wanted to go home basically had gone home. So that you were only left with a hard core of people who didn't want to go home because their homes mainly were occupied by Russia. So you had the Ukrainians who didn't want to go back to Ukraine while Ukraine was still part of the Soviet Union. They hoped the Ukraine would become an independent republic again. And you've got Poles from the east of the River Bug, which had been a part of Poland occupied by Russia. And they didn't want to go back under Russian occupation. And we had, at that time, only about 50 Baltic peoples from Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia. And they didn't want to go back home while their country was occupied by Russia. And unknown to us at this time, they sent through the length and breadth of Germany to other Baltic peoples to say, make your way to Hanau, because Hanau is a good camp, and we want to make it the Baltic centre for Germany. And so people flocked in. Although we were losing all our people going home, we were still having an influx of sometimes 100, 200 a day of these Baltic peoples. So whereas in October we should have been left with a camp of about 1,000 people, we found ourselves again with a camp of 5,000 to 6,000 people because these Baltic peoples flocked in. But of course then that was a very different problem because they had fled from the Baltic states in 1943, fleeing before the advancing Russians. So they were in Germany, really, they had chosen to go into Germany. There was no other place they could fly to if they were going to fly anywhere. It had to be west to Germany. But they were voluntarily in Germany, whereas the other people, the earlier people of the camp, had been definitely forced labour. And so when the Baltics came in, they had very many of their intellectuals with them. And so that they were much more capable then of organising themselves and running their own affairs than the earlier inhabitants of camp.
Well, yes, were you ever involved with the politics, though, with Russians sort of demanding people and you having
yes,
to say...
Yes, your question.
Yes, I wondered...
I started to find off on that.
Oh, well, no, that's, what all you've said has been most interesting yes. And relevant.
They had, from the very first, the United Nations had said that any of the nationals, the government officials or anybody... could come into the camps and interview their own nationals to iron out any problems, and this was very sensible, to iron out any problems that the nationals had with UNRWA and to see that they were being properly treated and very well housed. Now, in the early days, in the first 9 months, nobody really but the Russians took advantage of this because it was only going to be a temporary affair anyway. And the Polish government was in flux anyway, and these other governments of the Yugoslav and Hungary and so on were in no state really to send representatives into the camp. So very few of them took advantage of that, except the Russians. And the Russians, in the very early days, sent people periodically, usually Red Army personnel, into the camps to see if the nationals were being treated well. And so they posed a problem. Because the Russians, it's very difficult dealing with people who stem from different ideologies from oneself, from a different premise from oneself. And to the Russians, anybody who didn't want to go back to Russia was a traitor and could be shot. And therefore, these people who didn't want to go home were in embryo traitors, and they wanted them back home. And in vain did my husband argue with them interminably that he might regard a Britisher who wanted to go and live in the United States as misguided, but he would defend his right to live where he liked. But the Russians didn't see it like that. To them, they were traitors. And therefore, when the Russian army came into camp, there was always tremendous fear. Even amongst the Russians themselves, there was fear. And one could get on very well with the ordinary Russians. They were delightful people, hospitable and charming and gay. But as soon as the Red Army came in, then you had this atmosphere of fear coming in with them. So from the early days, they always had this right to come into camp. Well, as soon as the Baltic peoples came into camp, then, of course, they exercised this right much more, because they were determined that the Baltic should get back, be brought back to Russia, really, for extermination, rather than foment rebellion against Russia in Germany. And so we very often had very stormy meetings with these Russian personnel coming in.
But did you have to let them go, or could they stay in the camp?
No, the Russians had no method of forcibly ordering them to come out of camp, so that and very often my husband had to protect them. So that we had one Russian particularly hostile man. Major, can I just say it? So we had one particular Major Orloff who came in, and he was very hostile. To begin with, he accused my husband of trying to conceal the Baltic peoples by hiding them in the Italian camp and calling them Italians. Well, this was ridiculous. The Italian camp was always called the Italian camp because it had an Italian commander. The leader was a Carlo Pani, a very able and efficient man. And it was always housed all the various nationalities, because in the beginning, the majority of them were Italians. We call it the Italian camp, and that became its name. But this Russian major accused my husband of trying to conceal the vaults. Well, when that was all eventually sorted out, he demanded to see the leaders of the Baltic peoples. And so my husband sent for them, and he said that Carlo Pani, the Italian chief who still was in the camp and hadn't gone back home, that he and Carlo Pani would be those independent witnesses. And so the Baltic chiefs came in full of apprehension, and the Major Orloff said to the Estonian chief, "What nationality are you?" And Mr. Gruner said, "Estonian." And so the Major Orloff said, "There is no such place in Estonia, it is Russia." And then he said threateningly, "Now what nationality are you?" And the Estonian chief said, "I'm a free man, and I hope that I always will remain free." And he said it with a quiet dignity. But this was the sort of thing that one was battling against all the time. The Russians had no power, actually, to force them back home, but they did as much as they could, short of force, to get them back to Russia. And I was very fearful very often that my husband would be swept off to the Lubyanka in Moscow and put in prison. Because I don't know what happens now with United Nations in the field in places like Bosnia and so on. But when we joined it in 1944, we had to forswear our British nationality. And we had to take an oath of allegiance to the United Nations. We were given British passports, but we were told that they were only travel documents and that they afforded us no protection on the part of the British government. So we were as much under every other member of the United Nations, including Russia, as we were under Britain. And this was not a very pleasant position to be in vis-à-vis the Russians when they were being awkward. And I was very fearful that my husband might be swept off, because this was not beyond the bounds of possibility. Because we had in camp, we had a Russian chief, one of the very few academics that we had in the early days, a man called Popov. And we made Popov the chief of the Russian camp. And Dr. Popov fell in love with a Pole in the Polish camp. And he let it be known that he was not going to go back to Russia. He was going to marry this Pole and go back to Poland. Well, one Sunday, when we happened not to be in camp, the Red Army descended from the camp and swept Dr. Popov off, and that was the last that we heard of him. So people could be abducted in this way by the Russian army, and so I was very fearful in some of these interviews that this might happen to my husband.